So I'd like to also thank the organizers for inviting me, especially it's nice to be back at UCSB for my 20th reunion, getting my PhD here. And when I look around campus and the beach and everything, I wonder how it is that I actually managed to get a PhD with all these distractions. But so I'm going to be talking about what I call compressed supersymmetry. I'll start with some motivation, explain what I mean by compressed supersymmetry, and then talk about some selected LHC signals. Same sign tops plus missing energy, which I think is a very interesting one. In that signal, looking at the endpoints from Gluino decays, the answer to my solution for Constantine's homework from yesterday afternoon is stoponium. So I'll hopefully talk about that. If not, ask me about it in the question time. And then I hope to conclude, because if I don't conclude, you'll get mad at me. Okay, so let me start out by talking about the supersymmetric little hierarchy problem. The basic problem is in the MSSM, the condition for electroweak symmetry breaking is this equation right here to a very good approximation. The Z mass squared is a cancellation between mu squared and MHF squared. And the problem is that, at least in MSUGRA, one typically finds that the supersymmetry breaking Higgs mass squared is much, much larger than MZ squared when you have passed the constraints from LEP2, especially the Higgs mass constraint. So it looks like there's a percent level fine tuning of mu that's required. So confronted with this, we should ask, why does it happen and how can we fix it? And one possibility is that this is a generic feature of the MSSM. Another is that it's mostly a feature of MSUGRA. And I want to argue that the latter thing is actually the case. And so we should abandon MSUGRA. So taking MSUGRA near the gut scale, this is the main problem. It predicts a hierarchical mass spectrum at the TEV scale. And the point is, this is mostly the Gluino's fault. If you start with unified gay genome masses at the gut scale or Planck scale or anywhere like that, you get a big effect from running M3 down. It gets really large. It feeds into the Skorks. That feeds into especially H-up, MH-up squared, drives it very negative very quickly. And so putting it more precisely, you can write down a formula that expresses sort of a fine tuning at the electroweak scale. If you write minus MH up squared at the weak scale in terms of gut scale parameters, it looks like this, where I've written basically the six most important contributions, and then there are many terms with tiny coefficients. So there's a nice big ugly coefficient from the Gluino mass squared at the gut scale, and then there's actually an opposite sign term from the Wino mass at the gut scale. If you look at the scalar mass contributions, it turns out they approximately cancel. I should say these particular numbers come from SPS 1A prime. That basically tells you what the Yukawa couplings are. But you get basically the same sort of numbers for almost any MSUGRA model. Okay, and it was pointed out, this has been, I think, rediscovered by many people. The first place I know that explained it very clearly was Gordy Kane and Steve King's paper from 98, where they said, look, this, if M3 wasn't so large, first of all, this wouldn't be so bad. And secondly, you would get, it turns out, you get a cancellation between M3 hat and M2 hat. And so in particular, if you take a smaller Gluino mass, say M3 hat over M2 hat, the hat means at the gut scale, to be about a third. It doesn't have to be a third. It could be a fourth or 1 over 2.5 or something. Then this will be much smaller. As a result, mu squared will be much smaller. There's no particular reason why mu should be large. In fact, if it weren't for experimental constraints, you know, we would be perfectly happy with mu equals zero. It's perfectly natural. So this would lead to significantly less fine tuning in the MSSM. So there are lots of ways that this ratio of M3 over M2 could be smaller in MSUGRA. And I'll just pick one that happens to be about one of my favorites. And that is, you can suppose that the F terms that break supersymmetry include a singlet and an adjoint of SU5. Okay, so then at the gut scale, you can parameterize the gay genome masses in the following way. There's a common contribution that comes from the singlet F term, and then there's a non-common contribution that comes from the adjoint, which I call C24. So the special case C24 is the usual MSUGRA. And if you want this ratio to be, let's say, about a third, then you want C24 to be about 0.2, so about a fifth of this in this normalization, about a fifth of the Gugino mass supersymmetry breaking comes from an adjoint of SU5. Okay. So I want to emphasize that this is not, what I'm going to say doesn't depend crucially on that model. But in any case, if you take this speed less than one at the gut scale, the result is going to be a compressed supersymmetry spectrum with a smaller ratio of the masses of the heaviest superpartner and the LSP. Okay. So now I want to switch gears, and before I talk about specific models, and consider dark matter. So dark matter is also something that puts tension on parameter space, because WMAP and other experiments have basically pinned down that omega h squared is about 0.11. And in much of SUSY parameter space, the predicted thermal omega h squared for dark matter comes out too large. So you need some mechanism for efficient annihilation of LSPs in the early universe. And people have gone through the possibilities, and you can really classify them in a qualitative way. One way is the bulk region, and that is saying that LSPs annihilate efficiently through slepton exchange. This tends to be tough after LEP2. It's not impossible, but it's tough to accommodate this in LEP2 bounds at the same time. There's also the focus point, or you might call it the small mu region, where LSPs have enough Higgsino content to annihilate or co-annihilate to or through weak bosons through diagrams like these and others. And so here you need to get mu just right in order for this to work efficiently. There's also the Higgs resonance or funnel region where LSPs annihilate by S-channel pseudoscalar Higgs exchange. And here you need the LSP to be close to the pseudoscalar mass over 2. And how close you need to be depends on tangent beta. So it works a little more nicely if tangent beta is large. And then finally, there's a co-annihilation region, or maybe not finally, but there's a co-annihilation region where LSPs co-annihilate with sleptons or top squarks in thermal equilibrium. So you need a small mass difference between this fermion and the LSPs, and it needs to be tuned fairly well just to get this to work. So in compressed supersymmetry, there's another scenario that becomes natural because the LSP is naturally heavier than the top quark. And the top squark is naturally the next lightest superpartner. Okay. And so what that is para-annihilation of LSPs to top quarks. And I want to emphasize this is not the top squark co-annihilation region. It's continuously connected to it, but it's qualitatively distinct. So here are diagrams that lead to neutralino para-annihilation to TT bar. You have to be above the LSP mass has to be above the top mass for this to work. In compressed supersymmetry, if the very first model I plugged in and tried, it turns out this happens, and it's very generic, that stop exchange dominates. And the reason this can work is there's no P wave suppression because you have a large top quark mass. So your LSP can be heavier than, say, in the slepton bulk region. So to get, roughly speaking, to get omega h squared into that WMAP allowed range, here's what you need. You need M top to be less than the LSP mass, but it can't be too much heavier. It has to be less than about 100 GeV heavier. You need the top squark to be heavier than about 25 GeV more than the LSP mass, but it can't, again, be too heavy. It's got to be less than about 100 GeV less than the LSP mass. And these aren't mathematical theorems. These are rough things that happen. So in the following, I'm going to impose the constraint on thermal dark matter that it's in this range, and it's computed using micro omegas. No, you need one of the two stops there. It turns out that the other stop is not super heavy. It's below a TeV also. Yes, it is. So I'm also, in what I'm going to do, I'm going to also impose the Higgs mass constraint. Yeah. You have a moderate top squark mixing, and that's what helps push the top squark above the Higgs mass bound. There's been a tendency lately in the literature, I think, to exaggerate how heavy the top squarks have to be in the MSSM in order to get to evade the Higgs mass bound. If you have some top squark mixing, it's not that hard. So I'll show you a model where it works, and they aren't that heavy. So here's some allowed regions in the neutralino LSP versus top squark mass plane, right? And so the turquoise isn't showing up as well as I hoped, but these are WMAP allowed regions for different amounts of A0 is basically the top squirt mixing parameter. And so if you go way up here, you're in the top. Actually, this is the Stahl co-annihilation region. This is the top squirt co-annihilation region. And then as you go down here, these fat bulge regions are where top squirt mediated annihilation of LSPs to TT bar are dominating. Okay. So, and then you can actually go below this and re-enter the top squirt co-annihilation region. But for each of these, you're cut off on the lower end by, in fact, the Higgs mass constraint from Lepp. That's what cuts each of these things off. Okay. So, these bulgy regions are where I want to concentrate. They look to me like the less fine-tuned. If I throw a dartboard at parameter space, that's what I'm probably going to hit. So another thing is, okay, so this lower red line is just that the stop has to be lighter than heavier than the LSP. This red line is where the decay stop goes to WB neutralino is forbidden, and this line up here is where stop goes to top LSP is forbidden. So basically, that's always out in this scenario, and most of the time, this decay is also ruled out, and so stops are actually going to decay to charm neutralino in these models. That's not a mathematical theorem. You can see you can evade that here. Okay. So just to show you, so I'm doing all this, I'm taking M sugar and I'm adding on the C24 parameter. That's all I'm doing. That's just for simplicity. There's no particular theoretical reason behind it. But just to see what kind of scalar masses you need, this is the same regions, but now plotting M0 as a function of the neutralino LSP mass. So beating the LSP Higgs mass constraint almost, not quite, if you're in this case, if this case with very large mixing, it's not true, but it almost forces you to have your neutralino heavier than the top mass, and therefore to allow neutralino annihilations to TT bar. So I wanted to just show how this is related to other dark matter allowed regions. So this is a plot of, again, M0 versus C24 for various possibilities. The red band here is what's allowed by the WMAP, assuming thermal production of dark matter. And so there's a Stahl co-annihilation region that's down here. It's kind of a polygon. Up here, you got the focus point. Here, you've got the Wino co-annihilation. This is where M2 becomes very small, and your LSP has a significant Wino component. And then the region I'm most interested in is this one, annihilation to tops. Notice it would be continuously connected to the focus point if it weren't for the fact that that region actually gets cut out by what I've taken the Higgs mass constraint from left to be 113, taking into account that there are theoretical uncertainties in the Higgs mass prediction. Okay, so here's typical features of my favorite model point for compressed supersymmetry. So one thing to notice is that unlike in M-Sugra, where the ratio of the gluino to the LSP mass is about 6.5 or so, here it's more like about 3. Okay, and the ratio of the heaviest superpartner to the lightest superpartner is less than 4. So that in that sense, the spectrum is compressed. Notice that it's really compressed from the bottom up. You're basically pushing up, fixing the gluino mass, you're pushing up the rest of the spectrum. These states right here are actually Higgsino. The Wienos are way up here. Okay? And so if you look at what are the important decays for hadron colliders, the stop goes to charm neutralino. You're going to make a lot of gluinos, and they decay basically 100% to top stop. And we're going to see like sign stops from that. Left-handed squarks decay most of the time to quark gluino. Right-handed actually decay to quark LSP most of the time. Okay. So to summarize the second bullet point of my outline, compressed supersymmetry is what I call the idea that the gluino mass parameter is much smaller than the Wino mass parameter at the gut scale. The ratio of heaviest to lightest superpartners is less. It lessens the Susie-Little hierarchy problem. There's some overlap I think with the MSSM golden region that Maxime talked about earlier the week. It naturally allows the correct dark matter thermal relic abundance by a fairly distinctive scenario. If you ask, can you do this in M. Sugra, you can. You can do it, but it requires a couple of extreme fine tunings. You have to take the squirt masses to be extremely heavy and then take a gigantic A term and adjust it to 1 part in 10,000 or something. And then you can actually get this region to work. So that the fact that you have to do several or at least two fine tunings, and that makes me basically say that it almost can't happen in M-Suiter. So this has distinctive LHC phenomenology, and a couple of other groups have looked at models of this type recently. So in the following, just to be concrete, I'm going to be considering a model line. I fix C24 to be my favorite value. I'm going to vary the Beano mass. That sets the scale of all the superpartners. I'm going to vary that around, hold other things fixed to reasonable values. And then everywhere on this model line, stop goes to charm neutralino is 100%. So here's the mass difference between the stop and LSP as a function of the gluino mass. And so here's the big bulge region. This is where annihilation to TT bar is important. Here's where co-annihilations is important. And so they're continuously connected. There's some region there where you have a phase transition. Okay. So the bulge region here is actually good because it's going to give us enhanced detection efficiency at the LHC, just because there's a larger mass difference for the jet that you're going to get from the stop decay to charm. Okay, so here's the total SUSY production rate at the LHC. I don't think there's anything too surprising. You have a large stop anti-stop component. Gluino squark is quite important, and gluino is down here, but still important. I think if there's any justice in the world, there will be an early discovery with jets plus missing energy. I'm not going to show you anything about that because, well, as Clint Eastwood said in Dirty Harry, a man has to know his limitations, and I don't think I can do jets plus missing energy better than LHC experimentalists. So let me concentrate on something that's a little bit less, has a little bit less background. So you could say, but then what? There are a lot of challenges. Direct top squark pair production is a tough signal because those jets are really wimpy. Sleptons, Wienos, and Higgsinos, at least in this model line, very nearly decouple from the LHC. They just don't show up. You don't produce them directly in great numbers, and they don't appear in cascade decays in great numbers. There are no dilepton mass edges, and in fact, there are few isolated leptons except from top decays. But here's a distinctive signal, maybe the smoking gun, and that is if you pair produce gluinos, they decay like this, as I said before, and so 50% of the time, you'll get like-sign tops, a couple of charm jets, and missing energy. And just because of the Majorana nature of the gluinos, you're going to get, if they decay leptonically, you're going to get like-sign leptons, plus jets, plus missing energy. And I'm not going to assume that I can tag charm jets, because, again, that's too hard for me. But it might help in the far future. So signal has actually been looked at in a different context by Kramel and Racklev. Their models that they looked at differed in having a much lighter stop, actually less than M top, and their squarks were much heavier. So in my case, as I showed before, actually squark production in association with gluinos or by themselves is actually very important. And this is an added challenge for reconstructing SUSY events, or reconstructing them and understanding which process gave rise to them. So methodology, I used MadGraph, MadEvent to Pythia to PGS, just like the LHC Olympics. I require exactly two same sign isolated leptons with PT greater than 20, at least two BTAG jets with PT greater than 50, at least two more jets, because I want to separate from the top background a little, with PT greater than 50 or 35. And then I require you have two same sign lepton B assignments of pairs, each one of them giving an invariant mass less than 160. That makes it consistent with top decay, and missing energy greater than 100. So with these cuts, the standard model background is mostly TT bar. It's reputed to be, in several papers I've seen, less than one event per inverse femtobarn. However, one should be careful because this depends crucially on fake rates and wrong sign assignments for leptons. And those are difficult to anticipate before data taken. So that's a caveat. So here's the signal rates after cuts for these along this model line. This is sort of the bulge region, and you can see we're talking, so this is separated by gluino gives you the most, and then gluino squark here. And so it's in the range of 5 to 10 events per inverse femtobarns after cuts. And again, whether you can detect this will depend crucially on how well same sign lepton backgrounds can be understood. If hopefully the backgrounds are going to be much less than this, but I have no way of estimating. how often you're going to get a fake lepton charge assignment. So in the following, I'm just not going to include the backgrounds in the hopes that they're small after the cuts. That's what Kramel and Raklev argued. Okay, so if you look at the mass endpoints of the visible decay products of the Galeno, here's how the Galeno decays. And so you can look at various endpoints for the visible products, the B, the charm, and the lepton. If you look at B lepton, that's just the top decay. So this is fixed by standard model masses. It gives you no new information, but it does allow you to pair your B jets with your leptons and know which one went with which. The other endpoints contain information on the super partner masses, but it turns out they're all dependent on each other. There's only one new piece of information in each of these endpoints, right? Because here's what it is for the lepton charm. This is just some standard model factor. This is some standard model addition. So they all contain the same information. Different events populate the near endpoint regions of the three distributions, though. So in principle, they're all useful. Unfortunately, the lepton charm distribution tends to have a very soft, shallow approach to the endpoint. So it's harder to get an endpoint out of it. So there's good news and bad news about the endpoints. First, the bad news. In principle, they carry information about these masses. But in practice, they depend extremely weakly on the model. So if you plot along this model line what the Galeno mass is, you might expect the endpoint will move up scale somehow with the Galeno mass. But what you see is that especially in the bulge region where it's interesting, where I think we might be, it's almost flat. And the reason for that is actually, I don't want to go into too much detail, but it's actually this factor in front, which gets smaller and smaller as you move to higher and higher masses and compensates the fact that this term is getting larger and larger. That's unfortunate. That's bad news. However, let's try it anyway. So to get as clean a sample as possible, we'll select events with the same cuts as before, but now require there's a unique pairing of B jets and leptons. So if you have an event where one B can be paired with more than one lepton, you don't know which is which, so you throw it out. And then for each B lepton pair, that's telling you which is the top, you choose the jet with the smallest mass for BLC as the charm candidate. And you require it to have enough PT. Don't use any charm tagging. So we're just relying on the mass to tell us which is the right charm jet. And then we can look for endpoints in both of these variables. Okay, so here's a model where the nominal endpoint is at 350 GeV. Here's what the BLC invariant mass looks like. And so if you imagine that you can model your detector really well, you shouldn't trust this because, well, this is PGS, and PGS is pretty good. PGS is not great, okay? But I think this motivates the fact that you could imagine doing an analysis that tells you that, yeah, you saw an endpoint there. The endpoint here is, I should say, approaching this quasi-linearly like so. A lot of this stuff in the peak here is actually wrong assignments, because if you're far below the endpoint, a lot of times you're going to assign the wrong jet instead of the charm jet, because just some extra jet snuck in there and was an interloper and got assigned wrongly. But near the endpoint, you get more of them right. Okay, and so here's the same model, but now the B charm mass distribution. This time it looks, I don't know, that's the endpoint. It's supposed to be around 280. Again, it's quasi-linear approaching that endpoint. You have to use some imagination that you're going to fit this and derive that endpoint. Okay. But I said that this doesn't contain that much information if you just look along the model line. But so the good news is that if you can establish what that endpoint is, or actually if you can establish a bound on the endpoint, so let's say you know it's at least 350 GeV. Here I've plotted the LSP mass versus the Galeno mass, assuming that you've decided the endpoint is 350 GeV. And so this is for the minimum 85 GeV between the stop and the LSP. This is the minimum in which this signal would arise at all, because it's otherwise, if you're below this line, stop would not decay into charged neutralino. It would decay a different way, and you wouldn't have seen the signal. Okay, so if this interpretation of the data is right, well, you must be above the solid line, and then as the mass difference gets smaller, you move up. if this endpoint gets larger, then you move up too. And it may be easier to get a bound on the endpoint rather than find the endpoint itself. Okay. So we could hope to have a situation where we could say, oh, we're probably above this line. Okay, and then you can put in some model-dependent assumptions. You could say, well, okay, I think I know how dark matter comes about. It comes about from annihilation to TT bar, so I'm above here. And then I could say, well, I saw events. Let's say in some model you saw 10 events per inverse femtobar, and I could say, well, with some confidence I know I should have generated at least 4 events per inverse femtobar, and so I could schematically say that I should be below this line. So there's going to be a triangle here, and you could argue that plausibly we're somewhere within that triangle. And this is just one piece of information. Of course, there's other handles you can get on the data. Okay. So now let me switch gears and talk about the solution to Constantine's homework problem, a resonance. So it's usually said that in supersymmetry you don't get resonances. And that's just because you have invisible LSPs. They lead to missing energy, and you get no mass peaks. But compressed supersymmetry actually provides a possible exception. In fact, it's actually definitely an exception. It's just whether you can see it or not. And that's because of the long lifetime of the stop. So you can actually form stoponium, the S-wave bound state of stops. A long time ago, in a paper that I think is really underappreciated, I don't know, it's got 10 citations or something like that, because they wrote lots of other famous papers at the same time. They propose looking for PP goes to stoponium goes to gamma gamma. The stoponium is extremely narrow, so the width you see is effectively just that of the detector resolutions for diphotons, which is of order 1% at CMS and ATLAS. Well, it's funny you should ask. So the width of stoponium is a few MeV. Okay. So basically, throughout this parameter space, it's always stable enough to form. The binding energy is a few GeV. Okay. The width is a few MeV. This is the width for annihilation of the stops. The width for decay of the stops is actually much less than that. And typically, we're looking for a stoponium mass state between about 400 and 750. So unfortunately, stoponium mostly just decays to glue, but there's a huge background for that. About 0.4% of the time, it will decay to gamma-gamma, and that's what we're going to look for. Okay. So this is clearly not a discovery mode. I'm going to show you in a second that it takes a lot of integrated luminosity. The importance, though, is that it will give us a uniquely precise measurement of the top squirt mass. Okay. So we just look for a narrow diphoton mass peak against a smoothly falling background that I'm going to show you in a second. And to be conservative, what I'm going to do is just count events in a bin of width 4% around the diphoton mass, so I can be pretty sure that I've got all my stoponium events in one bin. I look at the side bins to figure out what the background ought to be, and use that to get a discovery criteria. So the irreducible physics backgrounds at leading order are just tree-level photon production. One loop from glu is also somewhat important. It turns out in this mass range, it's not so important. There's an important background from fakes, which are thought to be smaller, but I think the jury may be still out on that. So I'm going to optimistically assume that fakes are not a big problem. So if you just calculate at leading order, and I know this is for experts who've worked hard on calculating these backgrounds, this is not right. You got to apply K factors, but I'm going to not apply K factors to this, and I'm not going to apply K factor to the signal either, and hope that those roughly cancel. Okay, so the dashed line is the tree level, then there's the glue one loop. Notice there's a little kink there from the top loop threshold. And as you go to this has mostly been studied down here for the Higgs signal. Right, but I don't know of any ATLAS or CMS study that's in this intermediate range. There's also studies that are way out here for Randall-Sundrum gravitons going to diphotons, but I haven't seen a study in the middle. It would be nice to see one. Okay. So this background, as I said, is probably wrong. You've got to include loop effects and higher order corrections, but the actual background will be obtained from LHC data. So we don't even actually, to first approximation, we don't even need a calculation, hopefully. Okay, so I'm going to skip some of the details and just show you the luminosity that I find to be needed for various expected significances for two model lines that I chose roughly at random. This is actually the one I've been showing all along. As a function of the Stopponian mass in each case, so if you say that the Stopponian is about 500 GeV, that's a 250 GeV stop, about my favorite number, maybe a little heavier. That's going to definitely require more than 100 inverse femtobarns, I think. For smaller masses, it gets much better. And even if you got really lucky, a few tens of inverse femtobarns might do it for smaller masses here. There's some other effects that I haven't included here, which will help. And one is that you can produce excited states of stopponium, which then decay down to the ground state. And then that adds to the signal. Or they might decay directly. Either way, that can add something like 50% to the signal that I've shown here. But then again, I haven't included photon detection efficiency. So these are rough estimates. Okay, so let me conclude. I've described what I call compressed supersymmetry, that it gives a qualitatively distinct way of producing the correct relic abundance of dark matter, ameliorates the Susie-Little hierarchy problem, has distinctive LHC phenomenology of various types that I've described. Unfortunately, again, I want to emphasize, it typically gives no information or very little information about sleptons, wienos, or Higgs-Wienos. We have to be lucky, I think, to see anything about those. We may know nothing about them after the LHC. And another thing that's important to realize is that because we're compressing the spectrum from the bottom up, typically you see no visible superpartners, or maybe one if you're very lucky, at a 500 GeV linear collider. So I had to end on a down note, but that's it. Thanks.
You mentioned the higher stopponium states. Any chance of that the spin 1 version might decay through gamma or z into leptons?
Oh, well, the ground state can decay to gamma z. It's just that the branching fraction is extremely small.
No, I'm talking about the next one up, the spin 1.
Well, sorry?
Right. Gamma. Just an intermediate gamma or z.
I'm sorry, I'm still
The spin one, sort of like the
Oh, gamma or, okay, I get it.
Right. I mean, intermediate, off shell, obviously, to leptons.
Right, so I think the biggest there would be if you produce the 2s state and it decays to the 1p state. And I haven't thought about whether that would give a signal. Yeah, I haven't thought about it.
I mean, I guess if you try to produce the spin one guy directly, it's L equals 1, and there's probably some derivative suppression.
Yeah, you do.
Functions. I just don't know what the numbers are.
You can actually make the P wave states by producing S wave states,
sure,
and having them decay to the P wave.
Right.
And that will happen. But yeah, I haven't looked at the signal.
This scenario seems to have some possible overlap with the electric baryogenesis possibility. Does that work in this bold region, or?
It doesn't. In fact, they kind of meet and don't quite overlap, because the electric baryogenesis scenario requires the stop to be lighter than the top. I'm requiring the stop to be heavier than the top, right? And also in electric baryogenesis, they need their left-handed stop to be really, really heavy. I don't know what it is, 5 TeV or something like that. So it's a very uncompressed spectrum.
What are the other Higgs masses in this scenario?
There's nothing particularly special. I showed one model, I think. Yeah, they're pretty heavy. So you're in the decoupling limit, if that's what you're asking.
Two quick questions about the search that you described. The same sign, leptons. First question was, you assume something for B tagging. You're probably pretty, you know, on the high side, to get as much rate as possible. But that also lets in more C tags.
Right.
So there's some confusion, forgetting the endpoints and so forth. if you do you have a sense for whether you're better off losing statistics and going for a very pure tagging, or whether you're better off just trying to get as much rate as possible?
What I've tried is I've tried the loose PGS B tag and the tight PGS B tag. Mm-hmm. The loose tag works a little better, but you can do it with the tight B tag, which squishes the mistag rate for charms down to a low level, and it works almost as well. So
the other quick question was, what you didn't talk about, what you described was a sort of a difficult way of trying to figure out what the gluino mass was. Aren't you better off just looking at the PT spectrum of the B lepton systems to sort of see how much boost they've got and get a sense for the mass scales that way?
Right. So I tried that and a variety of things like that, and to me it looks really tough, actually. All of these things look tougher than I expected. But I looked at the PT spectrum for the bees and didn't see a dramatic change as I moved along the points on my model.
If you take the B lepton system that you've already reconstructed, though, did you do that specific thing? Or because I would have thought that has to be correlated with the boost at the tops, and that has to come directly from the gluino decay.
All of my bees are coming from tops that come from gluino decays.
The bees have an angular distribution, so they tend to, the PTs get spread out.
Right.
The tops are, the gluinos are at rest, so the tops actually get more of a boost.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've looked at the PTs, well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but I've looked at the PT spectrum of the bees, and there's not a dramatic trend, as dramatic a trend as I hoped as you would.
What I mean, you've chosen your B lepton pair so that they have invariant mass less than 155 or whatever.
Right.
So you have now a partially reconstructed top.
Mm-hmm.
And the PT of that system should be high if you have a higher gluino mass. That's what I was trying to say.
Right. One thing I haven't done is look at the PT of the B lepton system, if that's what you're asking. No, I haven't looked at that. That's a good idea.
So I just feel obligated to make one comment about your very last point, which is that in this spectrum, the new threshold, the first visible superpartner has a threshold of 520.
Yeah.
So if you have any flexibility about what the energy is, of course, we're going to know all this stuff before we break ground for the ILC.
That's right.
Maybe it's worth coming down a little more softly on that point.
No, I understand. I guess what I was really trying to say is that if this model or this model scenario is right, we will gain some potentially very valuable information from the LHC as regards the ILC.
I have one more question. Your LSP does it have a large higgsino content then?
It has a larger higgsino content than an M Sugre. It's not dominantly higgsino, it's dominantly Beano.
Yes.
So you can see where mu is. This is basically, these are the higgsinos. You can see that typically in M Sugre, mu is up here somewhere, right? And so just from that, you can tell that, okay, I'm mixing in a significant amount of higgsino there.
Okay, so I guess at an ILC, it wouldn't be necessarily impossible to use a gamma tag for seeing the neutralino signal.
Producing two LSPs with a gamma.
Right, yeah, that's something that Chen and Dries and I looked at. It and works in the higgsino case fairly well, so I don't know exactly where the boundary
is. Yeah, I don't know about that. I've talked to other people who say it's impossible, so I don't know.
In Jack, in his talk, he had a measure of fine-tuning, which was, what, 10th of the minus 2 or less in most of the Sugre region. So do you happen to know in this model what that measure of fine-tuning is?
No, I'm a fine-tuning denialist.
I refuse
to calculate measures of fine-tuning. To me, fine-tuning is, I look at it and I say, is that fine-tuned or not?
Yeah.
And
I'm with you on that, but I was just curious.
Okay. It came with my Mac. So.